You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. The Shell oil rig Polar Pioneer arrived in Port Angeles last week aboard the carrier Blue Marlin. The rig is undergoing inspection before heading to Seattle, where it will be anchored in Puget Sound for the spring. Some spectators welcomed the arrival of the oil rig. Others hope to use the moment to bring awareness to Shell's plans to drill for oil in the Arctic. Joshua McNichols was in Port Angeles and has the story of the oil rig's arrival in Washington waters.
The oil rig made a big impression as it came over the horizon early this morning, lit up like a castle floating on the sea. As it approached the harbor, kayakers slid into the water and paddled out to greet it. They looked so tiny next to that thing. That's why Greenpeace came out this morning, to capture that image, a David and Goliath moment. They hope a photograph like that could turn people against Arctic drilling. Up on shore, Greenpeace's Cassidy Sharp has her camera out. She's been waiting for the perfect shot.
This is it.
What's distinct about this view right now for you?
I think, honestly, just having the comparison between how big it is, seeing the beautiful mountains in the background, and then it's surrounded by, you know, the kayaks, and it just, I don't know, it sort of seems symbolic that the size of it is so overwhelming.
Not everyone sees the oil rig in the same light. Paul Gallagher came out to watch the rig arrive at sunrise. He's vice president of Foss Maritime out of Seattle. His workers are running the tugboats that guide the rig into the harbor.
I just think it's amazing that, you know, people built that and people loaded it and they delivered it here across the Pacific. I just think it's just a really interesting project.
And it'll mean jobs for workers here, too. Don Glover already has a job working on oil tankers in the shipyard. But the size of this thing, it drew him down to the beach.
And this just dwarfs those oil tankers, you know.
So when you see this, you probably see work.
Oh, yeah. That's why I'm down here. See if I can kind of get my foot in the door, you know.
The protesters were gone within a few hours. The rig and all its workers will stay in Port Angeles for a couple of weeks. Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
Nearly a 250,000 acres of forest burned in last summer's fires in and around the Klamath National Forest. The U.S. Forest Service is proposing a recovery plan that includes salvage logging and other elements critics say will damage wildlife habitat and make future fires more likely. Liam Moriarty explains.
The fires burned for the better part of 3 months late last summer and early fall. After prolonged drought and record high temperatures, much of the area burned at high intensity, leaving little but charred tree trunks and scorched earth. Klamath National Forest Supervisor Patricia Grantham says the fires created the equivalent of massive clear cuts.
There are places where there are thousands of acres of standing dead trees and, you know, not a green needle in sight.
Grantham says the proposed recovery plan has three primary objectives.
The first one is to reduce hazards to the public and to forest workers. The second objective is to take a look at recovering the value of the burned trees. And the third objective is to look at replanting areas that could benefit from replanting in order to accelerate the reestablishment of a forest.
With that in mind, the Forest Service is proposing to harvest fire-killed trees from roughly 12,000 acres, as well as clear trees along 650 miles of roads, utility corridors, and adjacent private land. Grantham says removing those trees will not only have a local economic benefit, but will enhance public safety and decrease the likelihood of future fires.
25 to 30 years out, when all of that standing dead material is going to fall down, there's going to be a brush component that's going to come in behind it. And, you know, we're going to have conditions that we just aren't really going to be able to safely address in fire suppression.
But Craig Tucker says the Forest Service's plan is a move in exactly the wrong direction.
We think what Klamath National Forest is trying to do is a continuation of a flawed land management policy that has made our forests and landscapes more prone to catastrophic wildfire.
Tucker is Klamath campaign director for the Karuk Indian tribe.
These epic fires we've seen in recent years is a direct result of 100 years of fire suppression and then the logging practices followed by the planting of tree plantations.
The Karuk tribe is joined by local environmental groups in opposing the plan. George Sexton is with the Ashland-based Klamath Siskiyou Wildland Center. He points to a pair of Oregon State University studies done on the impact of salvage logging and replanting operations in the wake of the 2002 Biscuit Fire in southern Oregon.
Both of those studies found that the practices that the Forest Service is proposing, the clear-cut salvage logging followed by the fiber plantation establishment, increase future fire hazard and decrease the natural regeneration of a conifer forest.
Opponents also object to the effort to fast-track the project by shortening public comment periods and limiting appeals. The Forest Service says it's necessary to get the timber salvaged before it rots and loses value. But George Sexton says that bypasses important citizen input.
That means that there won't be any outside review of what the Forest Service is proposing before a timber purchaser gets the timber and before the logging starts.
The Karuk tribe has proposed an alternative that would take only a third as much salvage timber as the Forest Service proposal. Officials say they're likely to revise their proposal in light of that and other suggestions made during the review process. The comment period ends April 27th. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
Last week, Washington's governor declared a drought emergency in about 44% of the state. Paige Browning reports the state's Department of Ecology has taken the lead on preparedness.
Leaders from the state departments of Ecology, Health, Fish and Wildlife, Agriculture, and Natural Resources are collaborating with local farmers and governments. With imminent low water supplies for agriculture and fish, Ecology wants to drill emergency wells, amend existing water rights, deepen river channels, and more. Ecology says the large cities have adequate municipal water storage, but small public systems are under watch. Ginny Stern at the Department of Health says all water systems should work with customers on efficiency.
We ask utilities who may have shallow supplies or supplies that may be very limited in their capacity to start with the basics. Find the leaks, manage your use, use only the water you want and that you need, use it smartly.
There's also concern about the upcoming fire season. DNR spokesperson Sandy Kaiser says they are doing wildfire outreach with fire-prone communities starting this month in Twisp and Omak.
Now, people can reduce fire risk to their homes and property by keeping dead vegetation off roofs and away from buildings.
The Department of Ecology expects drought in 24 river basins, but is now monitoring all 62 basins in the state. In Spokane, I'm Paige Browning.
The entire medical marijuana system in Washington will be going through some big changes. Current patients will need new authorization, and taxes will be imposed on distributors. Steve Jackson explains those changes.
Governor Inslee has signed legislation that overhauls the way medical marijuana patients will get their prescription in the state. Republican State Senator Ann Rivers was one author of the bill. She says currently they have no idea how many medical marijuana patients there are in Washington. Estimates range from 100,000 to 400,000. For starters, patients will need to get new authorization from the state to use pot for medical purposes.
Because the registry is also about our bad authorizers. We had authorizations given to fairly young kids by doctors of philosophy and doctors of theology and doctors of the metaphysical world. And the reality is that those people are not healthcare providers.
Rivers says once a patient has a new authorization, they'll have the option of joining a medical registry. If they opt to do so, they will get a price break on marijuana by not having to pay taxes on it and also be able to grow up to 15 plants at home. If a patient does not opt to join the registry, they'll be limited to 4 plants. Rivers says that registry will also let the state determine how many medical pot retailers will be needed and in what location. For those who want to sell medical marijuana, the law is different as well. Rivers says there are currently many fly-by-night medical stores that never have paid any state taxes. She says a new licensing process will weed out those types of operators, many of which came into being after the passage of Initiative 502 that legalized recreational marijuana.
If I was a medical marijuana shop owner prior to 502 passing and I had a business license and I was paying my taxes, mm-hmm. that is, I was trying to be a good actor, then when I go to apply with the Liquor Control Board for the medical store, all of those things would be weighted in my favor to allow me to get a license.
Rivers says they will also allow recreational stores to become medical marijuana outlets by getting a medical endorsement from the Department of Health. The bill also expands the number of strains of cannabis that authorized growers can produce to include more medically oriented pot, which contains the chemical CBD rather than THC, to ensure that there's an adequate supply of the types that can help medical marijuana patients. The new rules will go into effect officially in July of 2016. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
An audacious proposal to revive a roaring waterfall on the Columbia River drew heavy flack when it was discussed in the Oregon legislature last week. The idea is to uncover historic Celilo Falls by temporarily drawing down the reservoir behind the Dalles Dam. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
For thousands of years, Native peoples from across the Northwest gathered at Celilo Falls to fish and trade. It was so important in pre-European contact times that some historians nicknamed the Celilo area as the Wall Street of the West. In 1957, the enormous rapids and cascades disappeared under the rising waters behind newly constructed the Dalles Dam. Now a state representative from Beaverton has resurrected the idea of reviving the legendary waterfalls with a non-binding resolution. It would ask the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to assess the feasibility of lowering the Celilo Pool to reveal Celilo Falls for 1 to 2 weeks. But some of the intended beneficiaries of the gesture came to the Capitol to voice opposition. The inundation of the falls displaced Tabitha Whitefoot's tribal family more than half a century ago.
We're not going to see my hometown, Spearfish, we're not going to see it in its beauty or have our roots or have anything back the way it was. It's just going to be mud. And I don't know why people would want to do this.
Other Native Americans said uncovering the falls temporarily would be a cruel tease and reopen old wounds. The legislative sponsor indicated the measure will not move forward this session. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Riverside Energy is proposing to build a crude oil refinery in the Pacific Northwest. According to a company executive, one location being considered is the Port of Longview in southwest Washington. If built, the refinery would be the first on the West Coast in 25 years and the first ever on the Columbia River. Conrad Wilson reports.
Last year, Riverside Energy approached the Port of Longview about building a crude oil refinery. That's according to information and documents from last year that were obtained by the nonprofit environmental group Columbia Riverkeeper. The group got the documents through a public records request. It then made the records available to media outlets. Lou Sumas is the CEO of Riverside Energy. He says the proposal outlined in the documents is outdated, but he confirmed his company's planning to submit an updated proposal to the Port of Longview.
Our two teams are working together on that today, as we speak.
Sumas says Longview is just one of the sites Riverside Energy is considering for the oil refinery.
At this point, because we're in conversations with a variety of locations for this project in the Pacific Northwest, we're not prepared to go into project details at this point in time.
At least two aspects of the proposal haven't changed. Sumas says the refined oil would be used domestically, and the oil would be transported to the Pacific Northwest by rail.
If we rely on interior light sweet crude, the only mode of transportation for that to the regions outside of Texas in the U.S. are going to be by rail.
In the previous proposal, documents show oil coming to the refinery by rail from the Bakken region of North Dakota and Montana. Brent Vandenhoevel is the executive director of Columbia Riverkeeper.
This is shocking new information. Refineries are extremely polluting, highly toxic air pollution.
He also noted the potential dangers of transporting oil by rail, pointing to recent accidents involving oil trains. If built, Vandenhuvel says, the refinery would mean more air pollution and more trains.
There's a big question of whether we're moving into a new era of building refineries. Our fuel consumption is going down as we become more efficient. And so this really feels like it's a step in the wrong direction.
According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the last refinery was built in 2008 in Wyoming. Another much larger facility is scheduled to open in North Dakota. Ashley Hellenberg is a spokeswoman for the Port of Longview. She says the port's working with Riverside Energy and is awaiting an updated proposal from the company.
It's no surprise that the Pacific Northwest and the Columbia River in particular has been the focus of energy facilities for at least the last 5 years.
Hellenberg says the port did not yet know what the new proposal would include or when the company would send it. Last month, commissioners at the Port of Longview shot down a proposed propane and butane export terminal. I'm Conrad Wilson in Vancouver, Washington.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgan. Still ahead, this past winter, the roof caved in at Prineville's wood grain mill. No one was hurt, but workers say deferred maintenance led to widespread roof leaks.
I mean, it was like one drip, constant, on my forehead. And it's hard when you're grading, you know, with water coming down your face.
Amanda Peacher spoke with workers about the roof leaks and the lack of response to the maintenance issues. That story coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. A chance of rain this morning, rain this afternoon, breezy with high temperatures in the low 50s, south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, increasing to 15 to 25 miles per hour this afternoon. The rain chance 90%, rainfall amounts a tenth to a quarter of an inch. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says rain around midday, followed by post-frontal showers tonight into tomorrow, with a few widely scattered showers lingering into Saturday. Saturday night, another front pushes in with another chance of rain, with rain likely Sunday, also Monday, then scattered showers Tuesday and Wednesday. Highs continue in the high 50s, lows in the low 40s. Last November, the roof caved in at Wood Grain Millwork in Prineville, Oregon, after heavy snow. Today, an examination of the circumstances around the roof collapse. Former Wood Grain workers describe an environment where building maintenance was lax and the roof leaked for years. Amanda Peacher talked with them.
On a snowy day last November, Todd Halsey noticed something strange about the roof at Wood Grain Millwork. A section of the roof was sagging between two beams.
You could literally see a bow in the roof. It was looked like it was smiling there.
Halsey was a forklift driver. He says he had reported the sagging roof to a supervisor the day before, but now it looked worse. So he went to get a manager to take a second look.
We come around a corner back into the cut shop. I heard a pop, and then all of a sudden the roof opened up. You could see the sky.
As Halsey watched, a section of the roof, larger than a football field, collapsed directly in his path. Had it fallen a little later, Halsey says he would have been underneath it. The power went out and the air clouded with dust.
Undescribable. I mean, you could just hear metal bending and water running.
Nobody was hurt, but Halsey didn't know that at the time. He spent the next hour beaming the lights of his forklift into the darkness, searching for his coworkers. Now, when former workers talk about the roof collapse, they tend to say similar things.
I just thank God that nobody was killed, because I don't think it would have been a maiming. I think they would have died.
If it had been happened 15 minutes earlier, we might be going to funerals.
That's Brian Godet and Henry Helmholtz, former Wood Grain employees. At least 16 people regularly worked cutting lumber under the area where the roof came down. But some stayed home because of the snow, and a key piece of equipment was frozen on the morning of the collapse. So others who worked in the area were in a different part of the mill when the roof caved. Wood Grain declined requests for an interview, but the Wood Grain Millwork Vice President Greg Easton emailed a brief statement. Easton wrote, "Clearly the building is not new, but I had no reason to believe the integrity of the building was in doubt." Wood Grain is headquartered in Idaho. It owns five mills similar to the one in Prineville. Here's how the company describes itself in a video posted on YouTube.
Wood Grain Millwork is a global manufacturing company, and so we manufacture things like doors, moldings, and wood windows that are put into homes all over the country.
23 former workers say water leaked on saws, electrical panels, and people. They describe falling insulation and visible holes in the roof. Sarah Johnson Hartman graded lumber at Wood Grain.
I mean, it was like one drip, constant, on my forehead. And it's hard when you're grading, you know, with water coming down your face.
Peggy Murphy worked at the mill for 20 years.
Some of them just wasn't a drip. It was just a downpour on some of those machines.
Oregon's Occupational Safety and Health Administration sent an inspector to visit the mill after the roof collapse because of an anonymous complaint. But the OSHA inspector did not cite Wood Grain after the collapse. His report noted the roof fell after a snowfall. Wood Grain told the inspector that the roof was leaking just before it came down. The report noted a leak near an electrical panel that the company covered with plastic. During any site visit, inspectors can probe employers about safety concerns. But OSHA says the inspector didn't ask Wood Grain how long the roof had leaked. Michael Wood is the state administrator for OSHA.
This inspection could have been more thorough. With the ability to look at it in retrospect, it certainly should have been more thorough. He should have talked to some additional folks.
But Wood adds that the inspector did what he was supposed to do. His focus was on the collapse.
Because no one had been injured or had been killed, he handled it as a fairly routine inspection.
For Todd Halsey, the worker who saw the roof collapse right in front of him, there's one memory that sticks with him. Right after the collapse, he noted where some of his coworkers normally would have been standing.
There's a 3-foot round blowpipe that was laying on top of all their cut saws. If that cut shop at that time wouldn't have been broke down, then people would have been squished.
That image still haunts him. Amanda Peacher reporting.
The story continues as former Wood Grain workers describe an environment of deferred maintenance in spite of repeated notifications of the roof leaks. More from Amanda Peacher.
Before the roof collapse at Wood Grain Mill last November, the roof had problems.
Mainly water leaks.
Dennis Adams is a retired forklift mechanic.
In this area where the roof fell in, the water would pool up in the floor. Oh, it'd make a pool probably 40 feet in diameter.
One worker named the pool Lake Wood Grain. Todd Halsey, a forklift driver, says there was no way to drive around it.
I remember times that the puddle was 6 inches deep, our brakes were getting wet on our forklifts. They won't stop if your brakes get wet.
With every rain or snow, former workers say water leaked onto people, saws, and sometimes electrical panels. Wood Grain's internal safety committee minutes from 2010 that show that roof leaks came up as a problem even then. Tim Chandler, who chaired the committee, says the committee discussed leaks often.
Many, many, many times.
But Chandler adds he did not see the leaks as posing structural threat. He has a neurological condition that affects his voice.
No one there, including me, had any idea the structural integrity of the support system had been in any way undermined.
Wood Grain employees reported safety concerns through a system called Aim High Cards. Safety committee member Peggy Murphy says at one meeting, this was management's response.
Tell your people to quit filling out Aim High Cards about the roof. We're not going to fix it.
Wood Grain declined requests for in-person interviews. But in an email, Greg Easton, VP of Wood Grain Millwork, wrote, "Safety is a perpetual priority for all of our operations, and we work every day to improve."
They talked a lot of safety, but they never would fix stuff like they should.
Again, Todd Halsey.
They should have been patching holes in the roofs all over the whole plant.
Tuck Green worked in maintenance for 15 years before taking a different job at Wood Grain.
The buildings were falling down around themselves. Well, they kept the maintenance crew out.
Sam Rufner, supervisor in the cut shops, says maintenance was short-staffed, so his crew did a lot of things that would normally fall to maintenance.
I saw things that needed done, and we mostly did it after hours. I was scolded often. I said we were doing stuff that needs to be done.
On top of leaks, workers had to deal with the cold inside the mill. Wood Grain's policy stated that heat was for manufacturing purposes, not for comfort.
Even when it was 0 degrees.
That's Mary Sanislow, who worked in the cut shop. Workers wore thick layers to keep warm. They say cutting lumber requires dexterity, and that work was more challenging in bulky clothes. Oregon's Occupational Safety and Health Administration inspected the mill after the collapse in response to an anonymous complaint. OSHA did not cite the company. There's no state OSHA rule that requires a workplace to provide heat, but there are rules around maintaining dry floors and keeping water away from electrical panels. OSHA noted that there were leaks in the roof, But the OSHA inspector's focus was on the roof collapse. Michael Wood is the state OSHA administrator.
With hindsight and the advantage of reviewing it after the fact, perhaps I'd prefer that he'd asked a few more questions. But I don't think that translates into he didn't do his job. It's more of an acknowledgement that we can always do a little bit more thorough job than we did.
Wood says that with limited resources, the trade-off of digging deeper at one workplace might mean that OSHA inspects fewer workplaces overall. Peggy Murphy, who worked at the mill for 20 years, says she feels wronged.
You think about all this documentation that these people had year after year after year after year, but they're going to send you in there knowing that that roof was bad. To me, that's like this business, this product, this money is bigger than you.
After the collapse, Woodgrain shut down most of the mill and laid off nearly 200 workers. Amanda Peacher reporting.
And that is all for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.